Thank you very much. Would like to restart the meeting now. Just would like to make one brief announcement. Some of you might notice that Damon Silvers is no longer in the room. Just so you know, he actually has joined us now by telephone so we could listen in on the remainder of the discussion. So, Damon, I'm glad you're able to call in to listen in. I'm going to turn the floor over. Great. I'm going to turn the floor over to Greg Skates, Deputy Chief Auditor.
Thank you, Tom. At our last meeting in October of the Standing Advisory Group, we discussed Appendix K, one of the PCAOB's quality control standards related to global audit networks. Today we have a panel of representatives from global audit networks to discuss the quality control practices of their global audit networks, including the procedures contained in Appendix K, as well as the quality control practices in the audits of financial statements prepared in accordance with international financial reporting standards. Many global audit networks include domestic member firms that audit U.S. domestic issuers and foreign member firms that audit foreign private issuers. These domestic and foreign member firms can be associated with other member firms in a variety of ways and often use the same firm name as that of the domestic network firm. In addition, some global audit networks have created global offices to consult on IFRS, or International Financial Reporting Standards issues and implementation with their affiliated network firms. And in some cases, these offices perform the Appendix K filing reviews. The purpose of the panel presentation today is to foster a discussion about the quality control practices of global audit networks to help determine what changes might be needed to Appendix K or other PCAOB quality control standards. Now allow me to introduce our panelists for this session this afternoon. Guy Moore is a partner at Deloitte & Touche and serves as their National Director of Audit Assurance, Quality, and Risk. Guy has been with Deloitte for 25 years and prior to his current role has served Deloitte as a Regional Professional Practice Director, a consultation partner in Deloitte's Quality Assurance Group, and the partner in charge of Deloitte & Touche LLP Practice Review Program. Next to Guy is John Basil. John is a partner at Hayes & Company LLP, which is part of the Moore Stephens Hayes LLP and the Moore Stephens International Network. John has been with Hayes & Company for over 20 years and is responsible for many of the firm's practice areas, including both audit and SEC reporting, where he advises clients and the Moore Stephens International Network affiliates on U.S. GAAP reporting and SEC requirements. Next is Paul Herring. Paul is a partner at Grant Thornton International Limited and serves as their Executive Director, Risk and Regulatory Matters. Paul's responsibilities include the development and oversight of global policies and procedures for client acceptance and reacceptance, safeguarding professional independence, and preventing conflicts of interest. Next to Paul is Jack Day. Jack is a partner at Ernst & Young LLP and serves as the Global Director of Capital Markets and is responsible for quality control of assurance services provided to U.S. foreign private issuers. His responsibilities include accounting, auditing, and other professional practice matters. As with our previous panels, we have asked each panelist to present prepared remarks for about 10 minutes. After these prepared remarks, we will spend the remainder of the session in an open dialogue among the SAG members, panelists, the PCAOB, and observers. Now I'd like to turn the floor over to our panelists, starting with Guy Moore. Guy?
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure for me to be here today to talk about the global policies, guidance, and procedures of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. And from now on, I'm going to say DTT so I can get it all out of my mouth and maybe finish this within 10 minutes. I am a partner in Deloitte & Touche LLP, which is the U.S. member firm of DTT. As Greg indicated in his introduction of me, I've been in the public auditing profession for almost 36 years, almost 25 of those as a partner. I spent 26 years directly in client service, auditing service directly, 16 of those as an audit engagement partner, and the most recent 10 years in the Deloitte & Touche National Professional Practice Network, thus landing where I am today. In the late 90s, I was a member of the SEC Practice Section Task Force that developed what is now called Appendix K, thus the connection for me to be here today. In my remarks this afternoon, I intend to give an overview at a high level of the DTT global organization and structure, to discuss at a high level the DTT audit policies and quality control policies, discuss the internal inspection or so-called practice review program for DTT, the DTT approach and process for complying with Appendix K, and the filing review required under Appendix K, and then a few remarks about assistance that's provided by the DTT member firms to each other, and that would include the U.S. firm as well as by DTT itself. Including a short remarks about the IFRS consultations. DTT is an association of member firms in over 140 countries, with all told over 130,000 people. The member firms are independently owned, consistent with local, legal, regulatory, and professional requirements. No firm or firms control or are controlled by any of the other firms within the association. The firms are bound through an agreement in which they do receive the exclusive rights to use the name Deloitte and Touche and Tomatz and variations of that. And they also, in that agreement, agree to comply with common policies, including quality control and audit policies, and with the governance structure. DTT is governed by a board of directors, an executive committee called the executive, and has a global CEO, all of whom I just mentioned are selected from member firms. DTT has common audit policies and guidance that are based on and comply with the international auditing standards and quality control policies that are based on and comply with international quality control standards. All DTT member firms under the agreement are required to follow these policies and not change them or delete them, but member firms do add to them to comply with local requirements, such as here in the U.S., our firm here in the U.S. has added to the policies in order to comply with both U.S. GAAP as well as PCAOB standards. DTT has a common technology used by the member firms to drive consistent documentation and consistent application of the common audit approach, policies, and guidance. As to U.S. standards, DTT does have a process to recognize those auditors outside the U.S. who, through training and experience, have knowledge of U.S. GAAP and GAAP and relevant SEC and PCAOB rules, regulations, and standards. The policies, the audit policies for DTT and guidance are developed by the Technical Policy and Methodology Group, which is made up of the senior technical partner, audit partners from the largest member firms. And those policies and changes to them are approved by the Global Audit Leadership Team, which is comprised of the senior audit leaders from the 15 or so largest member firms. The common policies, guidance, and technology are designed to provide assurance that audits are performed by member firms in compliance with professional standards, whether on a single location audit or on a multinational audit. DTT has an inspection program for the audit practices of member firms, and that program is administered by the DTT Global Office. And this is an area both here in the U.S. as well as globally where there has been increased emphasis dedicated resources and focus over the last few years. They're essentially administered in two different ways. The larger, more developed member firms perform their inspection internally with oversight by DTT and a partner or partners from other member firms. For the other member firms, the inspection is performed by teams comprised of audit partners and managers from other member firms formed and overseen by the DTT Global Office. These inspections cover compliance with the audit policies and quality control policies, both at the firm level and at the engagement level. Individual engagements are selected and inspected in this process. In response to findings and results of these inspections, member firms are required to prepare action plans, and then there is follow-up to assure adherence to those action plans. Inspection results and action plans are reviewed by the Global Audit Leadership Team that I mentioned earlier, as well as the DTT Board. There are provisions for remedial and disciplinary actions in response to inspection results. And I guess a final word on inspections is they do include a sample of foreign private issuers that file in the U.S. In compliance with the requirements of Appendix K. Back in 1999, when the SEC practice section adopted the membership requirement that became known as Appendix K, the U.S. firm, as required under that membership requirement of the SECPS, sought adoption of the policies and procedures contained in Appendix K by DTT and the member firms, and that adoption did occur. Appendix K essentially has two specific aspects, a so-called filing review and then the internal inspection aspect of it, which I mentioned earlier. The DTT Global Director of Audit designates the filing reviewers to comply with Appendix K in collaboration with the U.S. member firm's SEC Services Department and National Office. The filing reviews are performed generally by partners in the DTT Global Offering Services Group, which includes both U.S. member firm partners as well as partners from other member firms. In addition to the filing review, registration statements to raise money in the U.S. are subjected to an SEC compliance review over and above the Appendix K review by the SEC Services Department in the U.S. firm's national office. The DTT organization, through its member firms, has significant consultation resources available to assist engagement teams on accounting and auditing matters. For example, for consultations on IFRS, we have a small global office in addition to seven centers around the globe, administered by the larger member firms, which provide consultation on IFRS questions. Another example of that assistance is at DTT firms, second partners and other professionals to other member firms to help develop knowledge and skills in their native country standards and assist in delivering quality audit services by the receiving firm. For example, we have numerous U.S. Partners and managers abroad working in other DTT member firms, and likewise there are numerous professionals from other DTT member firms that work here in the U.S. Well, that provides a high-level summary of the DTT organization, our quality control policies and procedures. I'll be happy to answer questions or participate in the discussion later.
Thanks. Thank you, Guy. I just want to thank the SAG for being provided the opportunity to come to speak here before you today and to give the smaller network perspective on how global quality control works in our environment. It's also quite a change of pace from my day-to-day activities, so I thank you again for that. It's nice to to have a change of pace every once in a while. Once again, or what I'd like to do is I'd like to discuss two of my main discussion topics today are, I guess, brought about by the discussion topics presented in the information provided. The quality control mechanisms in place at the network level and mechanisms in place at the network level to insist in implementation of IFRS. Those would be, I guess, the question or topic points provided for this discussion panel. Before I get into those two things, I'll probably spend most of my brief discussion on the mechanisms in place at the network and at the local level. I'll try to give you an idea or a flavor of how we go about operating and conducting our audits. But before I do that, I guess it's important to have an introduction or a brief introduction to our global, our global network or affiliation. I'm a partner at Moore Stephens Hayes. We're members of the Moore Stephens International affiliation of firms. Moore Stephens International is a global accounting and advisory organization. It's got with its headquarters in London. The network has over 350 independently owned and operated firms in 95 countries, and it incorporates approximately 19,000 people. To give you a sense for the size and structure of the organization, the objective of Moore Stephens International is to provide services of the highest quality. In particular, for this group, it certainly goes towards audit services. Member firms share common values, integrity, personal service, quality, and knowledge. But as we discuss these, I guess it's very important to discuss the network versus association dilemma. There's a potential for fundamental misunderstanding of this global audit network. The literature that we have today talks about global audit networks and foreign associated firms, and those terms are referred to in terms that would imply that they are equivalent, and this is really not the case. And the distinction between those two has fundamental implications for the operation and quality assurance programs by the firms, including monitoring and independence. Two of the most significant factors being common quality control procedures and policies in place and common brand name. These factors are certainly at this point not interpreted with any high degree of precision at this point. I don't think it's up to the panel, I guess, to decide where that goes, but there's still some uncertainty in that area. The network definition debate obviously remains unresolved. The network itself has an internal inspection or inspection process. It's organized out of the London office. It's not tailored to meet any of the specific requirements of the SEC or the PCAOB. All affiliated firms in the association, in Moore Stephens International, are expected to provide audit service in accordance with international auditing standards when called upon to do so by other affiliated firms. The process that's in place considers that a firm with a robust professional infrastructure is significantly more likely to deliver consistent quality of professional work. Accordingly, it's the position of Moore Stephens International that the firm-level model for quality control outlined in ISQC 1 is an effective model for use at the network level. It also facilitates the compliance with the revision or with the revisions of ISA 600 concerning the conduct of group audits. The operation of this model also involves gaining an understanding of the scope, frequency, and effectiveness of other review processes applied at the individual member firms. This is an important concept. The aim of this is to minimize duplication of effort without detracting from the effectiveness of this process. What that means is that the overall structure of this is to maximize the use of testing of quality monitoring processes applied at the individual firms, rather than solely by a central function undertaken to review individual audit files. This promotes an effective review process from the firm and the national levels and offers a more prompt response to emerging issues and changing environments. What this means is that the international organization places a reliance on on the other firm's infrastructure and internal controls or quality controls. For example, it's less likely to place a heavy or internal inspection or inspection process on U.S. registered firms. U.S. registered firms, as we know, have a very substantial process. We are monitored as U.S. firms. We're monitored by the PCAOB as a regulatory authority, AICPA, GAO, and state licensing authorities. So there's less likely that a common internal or quality control process would be appropriately applied at the international level. Future developments in this area with respect to Moore Stephens International is that they are now considering the use of U.S. registered PCAOB firms to be more involved in their review of other firms, so that they can, especially with registered firms outside the U.S. Now, how does this work at the local level? The firm level model is more the firm level model that we employ at the local level here in the U.S. is more aligned with ISA 600. The overall responsibility rests with the signing firm. We take the principal auditor approach. What that means is that if the U.S. firm, Moore Stephens Hayes, is the principal auditor, we take the approach that it's our responsibility and our firm's responsibility to make sure that the audits are conducted in accordance with our standards, irrespective of the international standards that's being employed. Appendix K for this purpose is insufficient for this purpose, because it doesn't really provide enough review of the files to get the signing firm comfortable with being the signing firm. Appendix K is limited to reading the document being filed with the SEC, discussing with the audit partner in charge of the engagements, understanding the U.S. auditing and accounting and reporting standards, and independence. There are significant differences between U.S. GAAP and reporting basis which must be discussed. This would work in an environment where there was a common level of control or quality control, but not in the environment that we work with. So Appendix K doesn't necessarily work for our organization. The principal audit approach, which we employ in the U.S., requires the engagement team or the audit engagement team to assume full responsibility for the audit procedures performed, and they are performed under PCAOB standards. The way we do this is we work with our international affiliates, but we take the approach that we are involved from the beginning of the process, from acceptance and continuance of the engagement. Our firm is involved. Our engagement partners and managers, and everyone in the audit team. The overall audit strategy and plan, the understanding of the environment, both at the client level and at the group level, materiality, risk assessments, responding to risk, consolidation issues, they're all monitored and reviewed at the local firm level. So the principal auditor is involved. The principal auditor, being the U.S. firm, is involved in the nature, time, and extent of the procedures being performed, including planning and field work review. The approval of the audit programs is also done at the local level. Engagement teams discussions happen at the local level as well. As an example, I'll be working with, I'm an engagement partner on a foreign private issuer, and what we'll do is I'll be involved from the acceptance of the engagement stage, the planning stage, the review of the files. I'll meet with the engagement team. I'll go to the local office. I'll meet with the client, meet with the audit committee if that's appropriate. And we understand also that, our clients may be much more scalable in terms of size and complexity than some of the other firms out there. So we're able to do this. It works for works for our organization. So that's the approach that we take at the local level. I guess the other discussion point was how the local or the international networks are dealing with the implementation of IFRS. As previously discussed, we don't have the global network approach. But what we are doing, and it creates kind of a dilemma for us, because as foreign private issuers are going to be filing an IFRS, we may not have the abilities to do that here in the U.S. or the U.S. local firms. Our local firms may not have the experience in IFRS, and what we're doing on the horizon is we're working with our foreign affiliates to to develop those skills. But presently, it's not likely that we, as the U.S. firms in our group, have the requisite skills to issue audit opinions on IFRS. It's a process; it's changing, and we're moving with the times. Also, it's a concern too. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm not sure from a regulatory standpoint if we can issue, as U.S. firms, can we issue audit reports under IFRS. I'm not sure if that complies or if there's any restriction with our state licensing authorities and such. So I think it's an area that we need to look to, but it's a developing area, and we need to keep moving forward in that area. Once again, I'll be happy to answer any questions as they come up afterwards. Paul?
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. First of all, just by way of introduction, as Greg mentioned, my name is Paul Herring. I'm a partner in the U.S. member firm of Grant Thornton. But unlike Guy and John, I work full-time in our international umbrella organization. Grant Thornton International is an organization similar to the structure that Guy outlined for Deloitte. So we have a series of independently owned and managed firms around the network. We made a clear, there was really no debate within Grant Thornton as to whether or not we were a network under IFAC when those new pronouncements came out. We clearly are. We have over 25,000 professionals operating around the world in over 100 countries and about 500 offices. The umbrella organization is a non-practicing membership organization, and each of the member firms have a membership agreement with that umbrella organization. We have approximately 40 or so member firms around the network that are registered with the PCAOB today, and approximately 8 of those firms currently are principal auditors for foreign private issuers. We have somewhere in excess of 400 U.S. SEC registrant audit clients around the network. So the structure is pretty similar to what Guy outlined. In terms of quality control practices, first of all, I wanted to just touch on audit methodology, policy training and tools. We do have and have had for some time a centrally developed audit methodology which is standardized around the network. There's centrally developed training on that audit methodology and use of the standard audit software. We're currently going through the rollout of a new improved methodology which is intended to improve the integration of risk assessment and looking at internal controls. The methodology has been designed to help ensure that U.S. public company audits are conducted in accordance with PCAOB audit standards. The U.S. firm's technical training and bulletins on U.S. GAAP and GAAP are made available to other member firms around the network. Those points which I just touched on with regard to standard audit methodology and policy and training, from a structural standpoint, are overseen by the practice. So we have a global practice leader for assurance, and those functions report up to that global leader. However, we have separated within our structure responsibility for the quality assurance aspects, both at the global level and then cascading down into the member firm. So, for example, we have a global independence function that reports up to myself. That function includes development of international policy on independence matters, global training provided with respect to those policies, and the use of an automated independence tracking system that we are deploying around the network to assist our personnel, member firms, and our global monitoring group to ensure compliance with the financial interest restriction rules. We We also have international independence checks that are required to be performed with other member firms around the network before not only new audit clients can be accepted, but also before any client can be accepted which has significant international operations, to protect not only the independence but also to guard against conflicts which may otherwise arise. Another area of quality assurance that we have taken a strong position on globally is client acceptance and reacceptance. A few years ago, we introduced a policy globally that required our global group to approve the acceptance and reacceptance of clients, assurance clients, that met certain higher risk criteria. With respect to our inspection program, we also have a global inspection function, which is staffed primarily with personnel drawn from member firms around the network, but is coordinated by a global group. The inspectors visit all firms in the network at least once every 3 years, and for PCAOB registered firms, they're visited at least once every 2 years. The scope of the inspections includes an assessment of compliance with GTI policies, procedures, and professional standards. And where the firm plays a substantial role in an audit of an SEC registrant, the inspection team is staffed with U.S. personnel to conduct inspection procedures that include consideration of compliance with U.S. GAAP, PCAOB, and SEC standards. In addition, there was a comment made earlier this morning about ISQC 1. Grant Thornton International is a member of the IFAC Forum of Firms, and we have declared compliance with the ISQC 1 provisions around the network. And the GTI inspection program includes an assessment of compliance with this standard for each of the firms. We do have a policy of following up, of course, with the results of those inspections. In fact, one of my personal priorities is to focus increasingly on a consistent response to the results of those inspections. I think that there is a judgment call that has to be made when you're looking at the results of inspections to determine whether, if you've got a firm that is not coming up to standards, whether that firm needs assistance in addressing that performance gap through whatever means are appropriate, or in extreme situations, if you've got a firm that you may from time to time conclude is not going to be able to close the gap, at which point expulsion from the network is deemed appropriate. Results of inspections are made available to other member firms to assist them in considering the extent to which they're able to rely on the work of those firms. And we have a project underway currently that I'm leading to explore ways of further increasing the transparency with respect to those inspection reports. We do, of course, have a gatekeeper function within our U.S. member firm, which reviews all SEC filings by Grant Thornton member firms, including non-U.S. member firms, non-member firm opinions. The reviews are performed by designated U.S. partners, supported by managers and partners on secondment in foreign countries where appropriate. We do not have a global markets group that performs these review functions. I'll touch briefly on the IFRS question, because I know that Jack's going to talk more about that. We do have a central IFRS group. It's a small group. That group focuses on a train-the-trainer model of ensuring that there's a consistent understanding of the current pronouncements that are out there, as well as new ones that emerge. They provide updates and communications around the network, and they provide a consultation service on points of interpretation and practical application of the IFRS standards. And then lastly, our U.S. firm is also developing its IFRS capabilities in a number of ways. I look forward to discussing further.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join the discussion. It's a pleasure to see many of you for the first time in a long time. I'm Jackson Day with Ernst & Young. I actually work for our global organization. I'm going to today focus primarily on IFRS. Before we move on, I would say that many of our practice and procedures with regard to quality control mechanisms would be similar to what's been said before, particularly if you consider the comments of Deloitte because of our size. I guess it's easiest maybe to give you a sense of how our IFRS organization starts out by talking a little bit about our global organization. You know, we have around 140 member firms in our network, which we oversee through seven area structures. We have a global professional practice committee that has oversight responsibility for the network with regard to consistent policies and practices. It's made up of representatives from the seven areas, as well as global. Underneath that umbrella would be our global IFRS group and our global capital markets group. Accordingly, our IFRS and filing reviews are managed or oversaw through the same seven areas. To give you a little bit of context about our member firms, they're obliged to adopt policies and procedures of EYG, including things like acceptance and continuance, training, quality risk management, consultation, global methodology. We have a global implementation tool, which we just updated, independence, globally coordinated internal inspections, and multi-location guidance. All those, of course, are consistent with ISQC1 that's been mentioned a few times today. We globally support really two gaps in our firm. We globally support U.S. GAAP through our U.S. member firm with the assistance of the Capital Markets Network along with the PCOB standards. And then we globally support IFRS in the international standards of auditing, principally through our global structure, because for many of our member countries or member firms, IFRS and or ISAs are in effect or substantially the national GAAP and GAS. Each country does own its own GAAP and GAS, as well as regulatory decisions along the way. So turning to IFRS, at the top we have our IFRS Policy Committee, which is, again, under the oversight of our Global PPD Committee. Similar, it has global and seven area representatives, the seven area representatives. In addition to that, its primary focus is setting the policy and making the firm interpretations. Supporting it at global is our IFRS services group. They provide the underlying infrastructure. They're kind of the doers. They do things like write the policies as directed, work on communications, guide, training activities, et cetera. It includes a global IFRS leader and a global IFRS technical leader, and it's London-based. Our IFRS area desk provide the representatives that make up the policy committee. We are a distributive model at Ernst & Young. We're probably a little more decentralized, I think, than some of our Big Four competitors in that we have a bit of a virtual national office. We have center, and the same for global. We have center with people around in our different areas. Everybody, I think, has some area oversight to some extent, but I think it's safe to say that we might be a little more distributed than some of the others. Our area desk would be principally involved in the execution of our quality control process besides their policy-making activity through the policy committee. They get involved principally with consultations, and, of course, they would work with the local regulators. So if you're working with you know, a domestic registrant here in the United States, and it was under IFRS, you know, you would work here with the area desk here. Now, with regard to QRM, IFRS QRM, we have policies that extend to things including interpretations, trainings, minimum standards of abilities in order to work on the engagement, which include education and an experience requirement, some oversight and approval type of situation. And in addition, it addresses things like consultations and expert reviews, which are in effect an extension of our quality review. And how does this all fit into foreign private issuers? Well, every foreign private issuer is subject to an IFRS area desk if they're using IFRS as their primary financial statements, or if they're as their primary financial statements. The assignments are made with global input from the global IFRS group, and their principal focus is IFRS accounting and disclosure. Contrast that, we have our filing review program, which focuses on the Appendix K requirements, which includes, of course, auditing, accounting, financial reporting, and independence, as Mr. Ray has previously pointed out, and we carry out those sort of activities through our filing review programs. We do make sure that our filing reviewers coordinate with our IFRS area people, or IFRS expert reviews, in order to surface any issues and to draw on each other's expertise in trying to make sure we have the best product out there. Now, one last thing I want to say in closing that is, I think, relevant in a broader sense is that, there are many exchanges in our global world these days, and people go different places. We kind of have this concept that the country of destination kind of owns their gap, their reporting, et cetera, and we do similar quality control procedures for all the different destinations, and that's something from our perspective that we continue to work on, and we're actively working on at the moment how to best do that to kind of protect our brand worldwide. Most of the international transactions we see go into multiple countries and often have a U.S. tranche these days. So I'll stop there and turn it back over to Greg.
Thank you, Jack. And I want to thank the panelists for providing us with this background for our discussion this afternoon. In order to generate some discussion along these lines, I'd like to first bring up before you the first discussion question. What quality controls will best promote accurate and consistent application of accounting and financial reporting requirements and audits of financial statements of issuers across the network and ensure that those audits are conducted in accordance with the federal securities laws and PCAOB standards? I'd like to now open it up for any comments and questions from the SAG members. Cynthia Richardson.
Actually, I have a quick question for the panelists. If each of you could say where your umbrella, your main organization, is legally incorporated and physically located, and I heard one or two of you say London, but I just, for informational purposes, would like to know that. And then my second question is, how are disagreements among member firms about what are the appropriate quality controls, procedures, processes, policies, how are those disagreements addressed or resolved?
Our the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu organization is legally a Swiss Verein, but our global office is located in London.
Cynthia, our as I mentioned earlier, our international organization is located in London, and with respect to how we deal with disagreements. As I mentioned earlier, the way we operate may probably a lot differently than the other panelists' firms, in that it's within our firm. It's the quality control procedures employed within our firm. So certainly there are processes for disagreements within the firm, and we follow those. But remember, as we take on the principal auditor approach, so we actually use our affiliates, work with our affiliates to make the work our own. So it's a little bit different in that regard.
Grant Thornton International is incorporated in the United Kingdom, and the physical office, head office, is in London also. In terms of in disagreements, with respect to disagreements on professional standards within an engagement, those policies tend to be determined at the national level within the member firms concerned. We do have policies in place for situations where there are other kinds of disagreements. If there are issues, for example, with respect to sharing of risk and liability across national boundaries, that's a tough issue, one which we do have some principles around. But the engagement disagreements are handled within the policies of the member firms.
Our organization is London-based. With regard to disagreements, we have a consultation chain that works through our global professional practice network. It depends on the nature of the issue at hand, but with regard to PCOB standards and U.S. GAAP, we would look to our U.S. member firm for advice and resolution of the matter.
Joe Carcello.
I have a question for Guy and then a question for Jack. Let me start with a question for Guy. You indicate that the Deloitte network is member firms in over 130 different countries. So the question I would have is, as you do internal inspections across those different firms, presumably you don't have exactly the same quality in each of 130 countries. That would be statistically impossible. So to the extent that you have differences in quality, a couple of questions. One is, do you then ratchet up either the frequency or the rigor of internal inspection processes in, let's say, year two and year three to make sure that level of performance improves? And the second question related to Guy is, you talk about the member firms agree to comply with common policies, common technology, so forth. What about common rules on evaluation and pay for people? Because unless the performance is very bad, presumably you're not going to kick a firm out of the network. It would probably have to be very bad for you to do that. So how do you discipline the individual partner if you don't have common standards for performance evaluation and pay? For Jack, the question I would ask you is, you talked a lot about IFRS. Has your firm basically, one of the things we talked about at our last meeting was the potential risk of IFRS allowing more earnings management. So a question I would ask is, if you took all of the companies that reported on the, let's say, U.S. GAAP, to the extent you have enough observations to do this beforehand, and then move to IFRS, have you seen a change in the mean and the variance of reported earnings numbers?
Okay, I'll go first. With respect to inspection results, I dare say that you're right. I don't know about statistically, but you are correct that there is varying quality, as illustrated by inspection results from firm to firm within the DTT network. As I mentioned earlier in my remarks, the results result in an action plan being developed as a result of the findings of an inspection of a firm, and those result that those action steps could go could range all the way from what I call more remedial, like training and so forth for the individuals involved, all the way to recommendations that the that individuals not continue to work on audits until they've completed enough remedial actions to again be allowed to do so. In terms of does that translate into frequency, an increase in frequency? I suppose it could, depending upon the severity of the findings or the belief that the action plans that have been agreed to and put in place are not being followed. I was going to get to that. As far as common, as far as evaluation, partner evaluation, and compensation, I'm really not qualified to to respond to that. Although I believe that's left up to the individual member firms. Having said that, as it relates to performance that would affect audit work on, for example, subsidiaries of U.S. companies that are audited by the U.S. firm, the U.S. lead partner has, or the lead partner on any engagement, I'm just using the U.S. firm as an example, has authority to oversee and to determine the that the qualifications of the people that are working on subsidiary audits are up to standard. So from that perspective, although that's not an directly an evaluation and a pay consideration, one would think that would have some indirect influence at least.
Yes, with regard to your question about mean and variance and the change in the IFRS numbers, as I'd start out by observing, that's more of a question of financial analysis versus auditing, and there might be others in the room that have done more work and would be more qualified to respond to that. I know there's some academic studies that I've seen and others have made some observations in those communities. From our perspective, I'm not aware that we've calculated the mean and variance on our clients. At least I haven't. There may be somebody else within the organization has. We have done some analysis with regard to differences and more from a perspective of trying to make sure we've identified them all, which included some quantified differences. And I will tell you that every industry is a little bit different, and to the extent that there are any trends that are outliers, it's there is a fair bit of variance. So it's been a couple of years since we've done that, so
Greg Jonas.
I was going to address myself to the discussion question, but if others had questions for the panel members, I'd be happy to yield the floor. Okay. I take from this discussion question that this is an aspirational question, meaning what would be ideal for a system of quality unconstrained by what is today? And it seems to me that what would be ideal we see every day in operation, and it's the way the firms conduct their own, for example, U.S. operations, where they work hard to minimize any barriers within the firm and work hard to develop common elements of quality control across the U.S. firm. And so I would think what would be ideal is to simply apply that same concept globally. And so we may have an underlying complex legal structure, but in terms of operations, control, it's a single global system uniformly applied around the world. I think in this regard, corporations, major corporations, global companies, are way ahead of the profession, where many companies have very complex underlying legal structures, but they have very tight, consistent policies and control around the world. And what I mean by common policies is a broad range of things: expert partner reviewers, training and credentialing, methodologies, policies governing conduct and protocols, standards groups, experts that people can consult with, internal inspection programs, incentive systems, management and control, including compensation and knowledge bases, would all be global. Why not?
John Morrissey.
Yeah, I actually want to get back to a point that Guy started to address, and I was really curious if the other panel members could touch on it as well. Because, you know, you talk about 120 countries, 96 countries, global organizations, clearly adds levels of complexity to any sort of management structure you might have. I can understand that. But, you know, as you touched on, Joseph, not every firm can, or every office can have the same level of quality. Okay. If you understand that as sort of a given, the question I would have then is, what do you do specifically when you have events of noncompliance with policies and procedures within the organization, and what actions are specifically taken in the past in order to ensure that the appropriate levels of either remediation have been affected or discipline has been meted out?
I'll see if I can pick up on that. I think it's what we tend to do is, first of all, look at the facts and circumstances in each case, because they do tend to differ tremendously. I think probably a starting point when you've got a performance gap is to ensure that there's an appropriate understanding of the standard to which the firm is being expected to comply. If you don't have a proper understanding, then it's hard to move beyond that. But assuming that there's a proper understanding, there's an expectation we have that management of that firm develop an action plan to respond to the performance gaps that have been identified and commit to that plan. That plan could include anything from shortcomings in documentation of their own policies and their own internal inspections. It could be issues with respect to performance of specific engagements. And so the remedial actions and the action plan will be dependent upon the nature of the particular shortcomings, but we'll expect, and those action plans typically will expect a pretty short time frame on them to ensure that action's taken promptly, and we'll follow up to determine whether or not those action plans have been implemented. Depends upon the time of year that the action plan takes place and the specific firm concerned, but at a minimum there's a follow-up visit to look at to see whether the specific actions were in fact executed, and then there'll be the specifics that were found as a result of that previous performance gap will then be the focus, of course, as part of the next inspection. If we have situations that arise where the action plan is not put into effect to our satisfaction, then we look to escalate that to more serious measures. So we have an ongoing process globally that reviews the status of performance of all of the firms in the network based upon their latest inspections and the status of action plans that they have committed to. And where we have firms that have failed to implement those action plans or are consistently failing to come up to the standards, then we'll have a series of remedial actions that we'll execute at the national board level, which in the extreme can result in expulsion. There are letters which would go, for example, from the chief executive to the managing partner of that firm, indicating that the performance of that firm is unsatisfactory, that they have not followed up on the action plan that they've committed to, And here are a series of consequences that will arise in the event that these things are not remedied, again, within a pretty short time frame. So there's essentially an escalation of pressure on that firm to comply. As I said, if they do not comply, there's an expulsion threat that ultimately can be executed.
Galen Hanson.
Despite the differences then between all of your organizations, which are very complex, we have these inspections, and if you can help me understand this a little bit, because Guy, both you and Paul commented on, I wouldn't call them rogue firms, but firms that are having struggles or difficulties and your reaction to them. In those situations, then, does the home office, and I'm assuming a U.S. home office of, let's say, an SEC registrant, do they accept that work, or do they send their teams abroad, their audit teams abroad, to examine working papers? And in your case, John, you said you used the principal audit rule, or principal auditor approach. Does that mean then that you don't accept the work of your foreign affiliate, or do you accept some of it? And where does independence come into this? Is there an independence check? I assume that the larger three of the firms here represented, there's an independence tracking. In your case, is there independence checking and tracking such that the public is aware of you know, any issues, or I guess put on notice? My question.
I'll go first, I guess, on that, to Galen's question. Do we accept the work of our foreign affiliates? In and of itself, no. That's not how we operate. Keeping in mind, as I said before, the scale of our clients are probably quite different than the clients of the other panelists. We're able to effectively work in that type of environment where we do send our U.S. audit teams to the offices of the foreign affiliates to work not only with the teams or the audit personnel of those affiliates, but also with the clients as well. Typically, the foreign private issuers that we are the engagement partner firm for are typically clients of the foreign affiliates. That's where their relationships lie, and so on and so forth. And they may have had offerings or registrations here in the U.S., so the relationships are there, so we work together with them. But once again, we take full responsibility for the work. So, yes, we send our audit teams. As I mentioned before, we get involved from the acceptance and planning and materiality and just as if we were doing it solely in our office with entirely our own staff. As far as independence, this also goes to scalability, I guess, of the clients. Our clients are much smaller. We're in direct communication with the affiliated firms and what they're, you know, what services they're providing, and any financial or ownership relationships that may or may not have. So I guess one other thing I'd like to point out is that we work only with our foreign affiliates that have agreed to be registered with the PCAOB. So we're not working with a firm that's not registered, doesn't have at least the baseline requirements of being PCAOB registered. So they're certainly representing that they have an understanding of the rules and the requirements. And we certainly inquire of the engagement team from the partner on down of independence issues and things that, you know, work that's being done. And that's how we approach it.
I'll make a couple of observations about the inspection process. Our inspection process is globally coordinated, similar to how Guy mentioned earlier. But it starts at the individual engagement level. And if we find a problem with an engagement, then we'll take that in consideration into next year's picks and follow-ups. Our remediation plans are at an individual engagement level, and we have a global consequence management policy, too,
that applies to the individual engagement level. I think that is very important and a very important complement to talking about, you know, firms where there may be more quality issues arise, because one of the observations I'll make from, you know, traveling around the world, et cetera, there are good people everywhere, and there are people that need a little help everywhere. Every now and again, you know, with regard to maybe a single country, it needs a little more help and influence. But for practical purposes, really to address the issues of quality in a global network, you got to start with the individual engagements and individual partners.
A couple of thoughts. With respect to, I alluded to this during my remarks, and in terms of there being numerous U.S. Firm personnel that are assigned currently in other member firms. I guess there are a couple of aspects here. One is that the lead audit partner for a U.S. registrant, depending upon the size of the company and you know the number of locations and so forth, will often regularly visit the various locations where audits are being done by other of subsidiaries or operations of other member firms by other member firms. And the purposes of that visit is, and usually he or she doesn't go alone. They usually take other members of the engagement team. Is several fold. One is to make sure they have a good understanding of the client's operations in those locations, but also to get to know and assess the audit personnel at those locations from the other member firms. And there will be times when there will be, I guess you'd call it additional processes put in place if there is a concern about a lack of knowledge or understanding or whatever it might be. And that might be having someone from the U.S. firm spend time there from the engagement team, or maybe on a broader basis it might be to have U.S. personnel to be located in that country, in that firm, for a longer period of time, as I said earlier, to help transfer knowledge and skills and so forth, you know, over a longer period of time. So, and I didn't comment before on to John's question. Oops, excuse me. But our processes in terms of escalation for action plans and failure to adhere to them are similar to what Paul discussed.
Wayne Collins.
I had a question for the panel. To what extent are the partners in each member firm, particularly the U.S. member firm, made aware of when there are quality issues uncovered during an inspection or otherwise of another member firm? I mean, it's one thing for some point person, let's say at the U.S. member firm, to become aware of this, but to what extent is this information permeating the firm itself in terms of the individual partners?
In our case, in the DTT case, if there's a significant negative finding in the audit work on a subsidiary of a U.S. registrant, the lead engagement partner in the U.S. is notified of that situation. And then we in our national office are notified of all of the situations within an inspection cycle in which that occurred.
As part of our acceptance and continuous procedures, we always inquire of the affiliated firm that we're working with the results of their internal inspections, Also, the results of their PCAOB inspections, they're all registered firms as well. We also inquire of their other regulatory body inspections. So, as part of our acceptance and continuance procedures, we inquire and look to the results of any deficiencies that may be noted.
At Grant Thornton, it's similar to Deloitte, not quite the same. The current policy is that the results of the inspections are made available. So there'd be a point person in the U.S. firm, to be specific to the U.S., for example, who would make inquiries of the global organization on the results of the inspections for those firms where there was reliance being placed for U.S. audits. And there'd be a letter would be provided for each of those firms. However, there are not specifics provided with regard to identifying specific client engagements. There are specifics provided if there are significant concerns, either about controls or performance issues at the firm concerns. So the expectation is that there's a communication then that would take place between representatives of the U.S. firm and the firm concerned.
In the case of the domestic registrant that you referred to, if there was a problem with quality around the world, as my understanding, the domestic registrant partner would be notified.